He's giving you 3 or 4 seconds. Alfred has asked that I describe the houses I have lived in. Do you know I have little concept of these houses? In my earlier years, I recall far more of the yards surrounding them. I was born in a little cottage in Pleasantville, Iowa. It was built almost entirely of black walnut wood, and I am told it still stands today. The first house we lived in at Decatur, I only remember it faced west, had few trees around it. There was a sidewalk in front where I could play with my little red wagon, and later we moved over on Walnut Street. Again, the house faced west, a big yard, several nice trees, and a garden. We kids particularly liked the red haw trees with their red berries. Could climb all over them and eat those berries. A big empty barn in the back, and we played there a lot. There was a cellar, and its entrance was outside at the back of the house. The cellar door was steep enough that it was good sliding, but none of you ever experienced the thrill of sliding down the cellar door. When we moved to Mount Pulaski, we got a better house, and by now I was taking more notice. First house at the west edge of town faced north, 3 bedrooms, parlor, dining room, and a kitchen. 2 small closets and a steep set of crude stairs to the attic. Attic floor had never been covered, so it wasn't very useful. Sliding doors between the dining room and the parlor, bay window in front room, large porch in front, seldom used, a smaller porch in the back, and a complete cellar under the whole house where we retired when tornadoes seemed imminent. And we got tornadoes once in a while. The cellar floor was bare, hard-packed clay, well-drained. Cooler down there on a hot summer day. Kerosene lamps for lighting. Soft bituminous coal for heating and cooking. Summer, a kerosene stove to cook on. Outside, a rather bare yard with several scraggy trees recently planted. A good cistern with a pump outside. Good fresh water for drinking we had to carry from across the street where the owner lived. Boards laid on the ground provided a walk to the rear of the lot and the usual installations, a privy, a coal shed, and a chicken shed. This layout was reasonably new and cost $8.50 a month rent. We stayed there several years. Then Dad bought the house at the north end of town. This house, some smaller but divided into rooms similar to the first place. No stairway to the attic, nor sliding doors between parlor and kitchen. No dining room. Nice front porch, small back porch, a small dark cellar, and a good well and a cistern. Yard was nice, with grass that always needed mowing, and plenty of good shade trees that supported swings, trapezes, and so forth, and lots of climbing. A number of fruit trees, including cherry, apple, plum, and a dense grape arbor leading to the rear of the lot and the usual installations. Also a nice big barn, and that barn was not painted red, but matched the house, which was unusual. A light gray. There was a well-built wooden walk from the house to the rear under that grape arbor. We were a little cramped here, so in a year or so, Dad added to the house. Took the partition from between the 2 small bedrooms, giving a nice sized room to Ruth and Esther. Then added 2 small bedrooms and a large kitchen. Ariel and I got the new bedrooms, and the old kitchen was turned into a dining room. In the kitchen, we had a sink, and at the end of it was a small pitcher pump, the rainwater from the cistern. Also next to this sink, very convenient to the supply of rainwater to be put into the hot water reservoir attached to the kitchen range. Our first kitchen stoves were the regular ranges you've seen pictures of, all cast iron, 4 legs, the front a little hearth with a door so you could regulate the airflow into the grate or the firebox and take out the ashes, 6 lids on the top surface, the 2 hottest ones directly over the firebox, and at the back of the stove top, about 24 inches above the stove top, was a warming oven with doors. The flue went through this warming oven. On cold days, you left the oven door down so it would help heat up the kitchen. These kitchen tops, stove tops, had lids and lid lifters, little iron handles with a cool handle onto it that you could lift a hot stove lid and set your pots right over the direct fire. This was used quite often. At first, the heating stoves were the standard cast iron fireboxes with steel sheet heating drums above. Ashtrays at the bottom and usually at each side were nickel-plated foot rails where you could toast your feet and quite often scorch the soles of your wet shoes after waiting in the snow. Also in due time, we got the newer kitchen range built like a sheet steel box that sat on the floor. Little difference between it and the old cast iron stove, but larger maybe, more efficient. It did have one wonderful new feature. A tea kettle setting on the back of the old cast iron stove was standard. It was your source of hot water. Today, think of the family's hot water supply being limited to one tea kettle. Of course, for baths on Saturday night, we put on the wash boiler, and after filling it full of soft water, built up a good wood fire. This new range had a soft water reservoir to furnish hot water in quantities. It was a large square copper tank holding probably 20 gallons or more, with the width of the range about 12 inches wide and depth down to the ash pit. There was a square inset built into the range up against the firebox. A corresponding projection as a part of the reservoir fitted neatly into this inset snugly up against the firebox. On the top was a lid you lifted and dipped out very hot water at all times needed. This tank was large enough and insulated so the water seldom had time to cool. If you were using the range too hard and the water got too hot to prevent burning out this inset, provision was made to tilt the reservoir slightly so that there was not direct contact with the copper box into the firewall. Worked pretty good. The heating stoves were replaced with one large hard coal or anthracite burner. We were really cooking on the back burner now. These stoves never went out as long as you kept the hopper filled. With very little attention, they fed the coal to the fire automatically. They were clean, no soot, easy to take care of. Wonderful heaters. This one, a huge monster of nickel plate with three sides, nothing but little windows, made of isinglass. Yes, you could see and enjoy the glow of the fire. You filled the hopper by pouring the fuel from a hod that was hooded. The anthracite came in small pellets about the size of plums or small eggs. A very clean fuel with little ash to remove. We bought this fuel before cold weather in amounts that would carry us through the winter. It was not always available in small amounts. At the extreme back end of our lot, butting onto the alley, we had a very large coal shed, divided into two sections. One side hard coal, one side soft coal. The anthracite, of course, was shipped in. But the soft coal came from our local mine and nearly always available. Often in the summer, the mine would have specials in 5 or 10 ton lots. To get away from the winter rush, often our soft coal was put up that way. The cost, $2 a ton. This was the days before floor rugs came on the market. Carpets stretched from wall to wall. You bought them by the yard, 1 yard wide, the length of the room, sewed them together by hand into a big sheet, and nailed them down with carpet tacks to the floor. Stretched them taut with a device called a stretcher. Deep pile carpets were unknown. You only had brooms to sweep with, along with the newly marketed sweepers. These sweepers were only little boxes with brushes, ineffective. The vacuum sweeper hadn't been invented yet. So this meant you took up this carpet at least once each year, hung it on the clothesline, and gave it a thorough beating to get rid of the dust. The floor was well swept and mopped, and then the carpet was relaid. Usually this was done in the spring. I'm sure you've heard of spring. In laying these carpets, we did not have these modern paddings to put under them. We used a heavy builder's paper, sometimes two thicknesses. This was not like today's tar paper. In some of the poorer houses, with no insulation for the floors, like a good foundation, some people resorted to different tactics. They would put oat straw from some farm stack and sprinkle a generous layer over the floor under that carpet. Now talk about pads. There was one couldn't be beat for a very short time. That straw, with use, just crumbled down into a fine dust, and my, what a mess. We tried it just once. Linoleums were used in kitchens and dining rooms, but bedrooms were usually bare floors with throw rugs. Alfred, you ask about furniture, and really I can't tell you much. Early in this new home, Dad bought a big square grand piano in a mahogany case. Today it would be a real antique. It was old then, but in perfect condition, too large for the home, I will agree, but Dad and the girls were very proud of it. Prior to that, we had a pump organ, one of those with a fancy but useless top. It too would be an antique. All of we kids were given piano lessons, but with me they were wasted. The girls all played very well. Mom had a favorite chair, a platform rocker, and there was a very comfortable wicker rocker that was a favorite of all. Bedroom furniture was all wood of various hardwoods. Bed springs were coil and not as good as we have today. Each bedroom had a dresser, and the larger bedrooms, many small clothes closets. On those dressers, they were built very much like your dressers of today, but a little bit higher, and had a mirror on top and two little drawers on each side on the top. And these in the center and on top of these two little drawers were marble slabs. You don't see that today anymore. Ariel and I had only nails and coat hooks at one corner of a wall, also some shelves. There was a pantry in the original kitchen used for storage. Kitchen had a table for six. We always sat at the same places. Dad at one end, Mom at the other. I sat at Dad's right, Esther opposite me, Ariel to my right, and Ruth at Mom's right. In the kitchen were some shelves and a cabinet for the dishes and so forth at the top. The center drawers for silverware, and below, pots and pans. Then we had another kind of a cabinet in the kitchen, and I don't believe you would be familiar with it, called a safe. A rather roomy cabinet with only shelves, all of the sides paneled with sheets of tin. The tin panels were pierced with tiny holes, usually in an intricate pattern. This was to give a flow of air through it, and food kept in there would not spoil so quickly. Also, these fine holes kept out the insects. Fine it was in the winter, and the safe was often used on the back porch in the summer. Remember, this was before the advent of refrigerators. To keep milk and butter fresh in hot summer, we had a trap door on the well platform and hung the butter and milk down close to the water on a rope. With this home, we started with kerosene lamps for light, then later added a gasoline lamp and various other kerosene mantle lights. Then one day, the electric company announced our neighborhood would get electric lights. Now, we did cook on the front burner. They had to install a street light up on our corner, so that brought the lines close to us. These street lights were not like today's. They burned big carbon sticks and were called arc lights. Required frequent attention. These were, in time, we got our lights. This meant one drop from the ceiling in each room, a 32-watt bulb in the living room and kitchen. Now, these were carbon filament lights, not the new lights like we have today. a 16 watt in each of the other rooms. The juice was turned on at the plant at sundown each day and turned off at sunrise. No service in daylight time. The meter was placed high up in the clothes closet in Mom and Dad's room. To get to this meter, they had to come in through the front door, through the parlor, through the bedroom, and into the closet, and needed a light to see it. Convenient. All of we kids had chores. The girls, mostly indoors, mine outside. The girls, the usual housekeeping chores, even much of the cooking. With me, it was take care of the livestock. Rooter meant cleaning the stalls, climbing into the mow, and pushing hay enough into the mangers. The biggest job was carrying enough water to all of the stock. Ashes had to be taken out and coal brought in. And with that front room heater, it meant lifting that hod to the top of the stove and pouring the coal into the hopper. At first, I wasn't up to handling a full hod. Then, most important, I had to scrounge the kindling to make the morning fire in the kitchen stove. It had to be a good handful and dry. Luckily, I could usually get plenty of wood boxes at the grocery store. This was the time before cardboard cartons came on the market. Mom would not trust the milking to anyone else, but there was the chickens to be fed and watered, and in the summertime, the cow had to be staked out a lot to conserve the pasture, and that meant more troubles getting her watered, as she was further from home. I solved the problem by building a small two-wheeled cart just held 5-gallon lard cans. One trip, and I didn't carry. Merry Christmas. At Mount Pulaski, a small town, and everybody knew everybody, Andy Reinders, the local druggist and a friend of Dad's, had the onlyest authentic Santa Claus suit in the little town. It was his pleasure to don this uniform on Christmas Eve, shoulder his well-filled pack, and then go through town and barge in most any place that looked inviting where there was kids and he could spread good cheer. Andy had no kids of his own, and he did enjoy these jaunts. One Christmas, Gerard going on too, I borrowed Andy's suit, and to make it real, I would deliver his Christmas first class. It was a flat bust. Reminds me of the song on the radio constantly singing right now. Santa didn't come down the chimney, so Mama must have let him in. Santa looked a lot like Daddy, and Daddy looked a lot like him. Gerard was totally unimpressed with either me or the things I had brought. He was busy playing with his own toys and insisted that as I was home that I just sit down on the floor and play with him, even if I was dressed up like that. I never tried dressing up like that again, and he's been about that blasé ever since. I've told you how old Charlie, the horse, added to we children's lives by enabling us to go places and do things. I often get hungry for the Jonathan apples we used to get in the fall season. Apples were quite common through the countryside, but everybody didn't have Jonathans. Dad had a friend out south of town, had quite an orchard, not big enough to be commercial, and larger than a family needed. Different varieties, but mostly our favorites. He offered Dad a deal. All the apples we could use, 50 cents a bushel, but we pick them. We were in apple heaven, and the deal lasted several years. We ate apples till they came out of our ears. Then we stored the cellar full. Someone had a bright idea, cider, and you have never tasted cider till you have had some of Jonathan apple cider. Took quite a lot of apples, and then you had to go to a saloon and buy an empty whiskey barrel. This whiskey barrel cost $1. And in that time, most of the whiskey was sold in bulk rather than bottled. These barrels, solid oak, made excellent cider containers, and after you emptied them, you sawed them in the middle and had two fine oak tubs. It was rather rather heavy, but they sure lasted. There was a cider mill in the town where they pressed out the juice for a fee, and all you had to do was take it home and use it up. Mom canned lots of it in half-gallon glass jars, and we had it for a long time. The balance of it was put in the cellar and saved for winter, and then what was left over, a little mother of vinegar was added to it to start it off, and in time we had some of the finest cider vinegar you ever tasted. Ever notice on the vinegar bottles you buy today, diluted with water to 5%? None of that hoopla in our day, to say nothing of the extra goodness of the Jonathan flavor. All around the barber shop, the monkey chased the weasel. The monkey stubbed his toe and fell, and pop went the weasel. I don't know how that got in here. This job that Alfred's wished off onto me has about got me floored. He gives me topics to relate, like transportation. I start out okay, but before I know it, I get into a different subject and even a different generation. But today I feel better about it. Yesterday I made my customary trip to the doctor for checkup, and waiting glanced through his Time magazine. In it, I read an article by Lowell Thomas, who is now 86 years. He quoted, "After 80, everything you write or talk about reminds you of something else. And this is what gets in the way this time. Someday you'll go through my junk and souvenirs from the studio and marvel at the uselessness of all of it. Among the rubbish, you should find a small square brown bottle, well capped, holds about 3 or 4 ounces. On one of its square sides is pasted a piece of white paper with a line drawn through the middle. Above the line, in black ink, is a big O. Below the line, the letter C. The contents, what else? Old Crow. How come? It's been there many, many years. Maybe 25 years. Alfred will remember the contractor who built the building for Joe Seiler. At least he should remember the many little extra touches he left. You all should remember Murphy's Law. If anything can go wrong, it will. Well, this contractor had a law also. If anything could be left undone, botched up, or uncompleted, he would leave it that way. His crowning effort was Joe's restroom in the back of the store. It went in last, and some way he came up with too little space and had to leave out the washstand. Barely room to get in and shut the door. Failed to put in a ceiling, so it was a little narrow shaft, went clear up to the rafters. Jetting out into the upper spaces were ends of boards and braces and many cobwebs. But it answered the purpose when needed. One year, Joe had been very busy, time running out fast, and it was time to clean house and decorate the store for Christmas. So they started at the front and did a fine job clear to the rear. The restroom was last, and it fell to Miguel to go back there and clean it up. He did a good job, and then reared back on his heels and looked at that awful mess overhead. He took his duster and reached what he could. Then, in the burst of energy, he put down the lid on the commode, and stepping up on it, he reached for more dust. Once he twisted a bit, and leaning against the wall so he could reach more, he had a new view. And there, on a board well hidden, was his shining glass bottle of Old Crow, about half full. Who could have put it there? Who else had stood up on that commode? He brought it down and gave it to Joe, and they decided one of the original carpenters had left it and failed to retrieve it when the job was over. So Joe's gang held a jubilee, but Joe, thinking of me, brought it over to show me and insisted I should have my share, so that accounts for the little bottle of OC. Most of you will remember Clyde Wright and Virginia, his wife, ran the Blucher Ranch to the south of us. I used to see them often and enjoy a short chat when they always stopped at the shoe shop next door. In his latter years, Clyde had health problems, and when he needed restrooms, which he did frequently, Joe's was always handy when he was in town. The doctor had told Clyde he absolutely was to drink no whiskey, so Virginia had to ride herd on him closely, especially when he was in town. So one bright day, he arrived at Joe's, all smiles and good cheer, Virginia patiently waiting in the car. He hurried back to the restroom, gone about 2 minutes, and came out a raging demon. He slapped his hat viciously and cussed a blue streak. Some SOB had stole his bottle and demanded that Joe tell him who had been back there since his last visit. He was so worked up, Joe was afraid to tell him what really happened. I bet Virginia earned her crown that day going home. Now they are advertising a stove built like a fireplace with an open grate. Mother and I had one of those early in our marriage, and it was treasured. We bought it second-handed, and it burned coal. Was reasonably successful. Also advertised as a high oven range. We also had that more than 50 years ago. In your album is a picture of Mother taking bread out of the oven, and that was before Gerard was born. When I was out of school, I went to work in a dry goods and general store, supposed to be the dry goods side, mainly replacing stock, decorating show windows, installing carpets, and so forth. But on busy Saturdays, I worked on the grocery side. Then the family bought the variety store, and we moved to the apartment over the store. This didn't work out too good, so Dad wanted to move to Carlinville, a bigger town, and it was time I was getting ready to follow him. In Carlinville, we moved to a very nice house in the north end of town. We did not stay there very long, nor do I remember much about it. Came this chance to have a second studio in a little town close by called Greenfield, and this did have its advantages, but also problems. We stayed there about a year. We rented a little house, nice place, owned by an old widower who lived in the little quarters on the back of the place. He was very friendly, and we got along fine. My studio landlord was a character, an older man who considered himself a retired photographer, but now he sold buggies for horses, also dabbled in automobiles, pianos, and insurance, mostly. He sat in his office with his little pet dog on his lap and read the paper. I had to go through his establishment to get to the stairway leading to my studio upstairs. In that day and time, all studios were upstairs, where they could have a skylight. He was also the town's piano tuner, and that's where I learned to tune a piano. Notice I said a piano. You all know the basics of a piano, wire strings taut on a heavy steel frame, wires attached to pegs that can be tightened like a screw or a bolt. They accomplish this with a tool called a hammer. Some notes are produced with more than a single wire, and this complicates things. I don't remember too much of the routine, but you start, say, from middle C with a tuning fork, then from C to G, and so on. A piano came in for him to tune, and it gave him a lot of trouble. For some reason, nothing worked. As he explained to me, tune C first, then set G as good as you can strike, as you can, and then strike both keys at the same time. Tighten or loosen the G till both blend out and fade out together with no waver. Every time he tried it, it got a bit worse, and it wound up both of them sounding C. Finally, he got so mad, and in his fit of anger, he took his hammer and loosened every peg on the keyboard. Then he had a real mess, starting over and couldn't get past middle C. He asked me to read the instructions and try it. So he tried it my way. I got the middle C with a tuning fork, and then, by humming the scale, put in the whole scale without proving it, which worried the life out of him. After getting the basic finishing by humming or guesswork, we started proving, and I had the hardest time keeping him from loosening the G instead of tightening. And after he once got over that hump, he was all right. But it took him a long, long time to get the whole keyboard in tune again so it would hold. That was a crazy thing for him to do. Do all of you notice the increase in the pickup truck population, or is it just in Texas that the increase shows? When I see them in clusters, I am reminded of the parody song in the movie Rancho Deluxe. Oh, give me a home with a low-interest loan, a girl, and two pickup trucks, a color TV, and all the beer should be free, and that will be Rancho Deluxe. Tanner has just been recalling the saga of old Toots, the Spitz dog the Franzes gave your mother one time. He was with the Franz family when we lived in Fremont, and they always kept him tied up and never let his kids go near him. Claimed he was mean, would bite, he was rough, and ran away any time he could get loose. Even after they moved to their farm, they kept him tied up. Our dog, Bill, had been killed on the highway, and we had no dog. Mrs. Franz offered Mother Toots, but at the same time warned her about his ill temper and his penchant for running away. Mother, a bit uneasy over being on the farm alone with no dog, took her up and loaded him in the car and took him home, tied him securely out in the back in the front yard, and started worrying. In the afternoon, with school out, you kids got home, and to your surprise, there was Toots. Before Mother could stop you, you were greeting him like an old friend, and he was just eating it up. You played with him and petted him till supper time. And when you went into the house, there he sat, the most lonesome, discarded waif you ever saw. Mother couldn't stand it, so she went out and untied him, turned him loose, and said, well, if he runs off, we'll just have to give him up. He was so happy to be turned loose and followed her back to the house and lay down on the porch quietly. Anyone went to the door to check up on him, he beat a tattoo with his tail. The next morning, he was still there on the porch, ready to greet him for the new day, eager to go along to get up the cows or go any place or do anything you boys wanted to do. He was a wonderful varmint dog and enjoyed hunting. Tanner says, though, he had one strange habit. If you boys went and stayed as a group, he stayed with you. But if you divided, he went with the youngest or littlest boy. If you older boys left and the littlest one stayed home, outside, he stayed home also. And one day this paid off. You two older boys went off up towards the well. Alfred, still quite small, played close to the house in the yard, Mother watching him through the window. She had a small flower bed not too far from the house, and for some reason, Alfred started towards this flower bed. And as he neared it, came that horrible rattler's warning. He was angry, and your mother saw and heard this. Impossible for her to do a thing. It happened so fast, and her in the house. But Toots was there. He sprang into action with the first rattle, rushed in ahead of Alfred, pretty near knocking him over, and threw the snake out in the clear. You older boys heard the commotion and got there in time to kill the snake. Your mother survived. And after she had recovered her fright, she hugged old Toots and went to town and got him a steak as an award. Is it any wonder Toots was loved? Here at Alice, we of course have the usual county fair, likely very similar to all the fairs in smaller communities like this. Also, like most other fairs, something for everybody, and especially the younger fry. They are strongly drawn to the carnival that shows up for the occasion. Back when the kids were all little, both Alfred and Tanner's came to town at fair time. And, of course, we had to go. They enjoyed it. All of it. But the highlight of the evening was when we let them do the carnival and the rides, up in grand style. At one point, Beezy and Kay paused just long enough to tell me, "Grandpa, this is just like a county fair." After they got out of earshot, I asked Alfred what all that meant. "Oh, they've been following a TV program called County Fair. Now they're living just what they've been watching and eating it up." Back a little ways, I talked of old Toots and his penchant for staying at home. But I failed to mention he finally learned to run away. On school days, he learned to leave home 15 minutes ahead of your mother with the car. When she arrived to pick you kids up, there he was with you, all ready to join in on the ride home, and strange to say, none objected. Mother never figured out how he learned to do that trick. You boys will likely remember my telling you that old saw my grandmother related to me. Keep something 7 years and you will find a use for it. You all will recall the old Barkle lounger and the fun it gave you, spills and all. Which one could rock the most times by just sitting perfectly still in balance and only moving your hands? You all outgrew it, so eventually it was relegated to the attic in the garage till this summer, 1978. Gerard and Evelyn brought little Amy to stay for 2 weeks. I wondered what on earth would we ever find to keep her entertained. The first day she stumped me by asking for a laying down chair. This was for out in the yard. Finally, I thought of the old Barca lounger and rescued it and washed the dust and cobwebs away. Amy gave it one look. It definitely was adult and offered challenges. It was just what the doctor ordered. She quickly mastered the limitations after being ditched a couple of times and turned that old chair into more uses than you could imagine. Quite often it served as a railroad engine with a train consisting of Gerard, Evelyn, and I in a row behind her. She did most of the tooting and the bell ringing. One time she announced we were going to Chicago, and when I asked how long it was going to take to get there, she answered 8 minutes. We traveled to lots of places. Gerard found a rope I had in the garage and put up a swing on a rather high limb. But nothing fazed Amy, and she was ready to be swung any time a pusher was available. Only no one ever pushed her quite as high as she thought she was capable of swinging. She liked to take walks, particularly down on the river when a little water was running. She would get interested in most anything. We took her to the park, too, but the greatest fun was to slide down the levee banks on the lake on a big piece of cardboard. Another of her playthings was a little Maltese mother kitten with babies who came to visit. Amy quickly named her Brenda, and she still comes to see us. Yes, I think her visit was a complete success, and we miss her. Another Christmas has come and gone, and again I marvel over the immense number of small Christmas trees it takes to celebrate this holiday. I was in Houston just before Thanksgiving, and it looked like they had a tree for every man, woman, and child in the state of Texas. Every smaller town also had a supply, and everybody was urged to get their trees early because there were not enough to go around. I happened to be talking to a lady in Corpus about these trees and mentioned the difference between now and the years when you boys were small. She agreed with me and said, "Why, you weren't different. You weren't different at all. That was the custom all through South Texas." I had told her how Mother and I and you boys would go out into the brush and hunt for a small tree or a shrub that would make a tree for our use. We usually settled for a shapely little ebony. And again the lady answered, "Why, that's what we all used." And the traditional ornamentation was followed. Cranberries and popcorn, strung on strings, were the main decoration. Ginger cookies in various shapes with a few glass balls and tinsel, with a star for the top and little metal clip holders for wax candles. All these had been carefully packed away from the year before and would be saved again. It was Christmas. Tonner adds, but after the Ethel became large enough, it displaced the brush hunt. Instead, for weeks ahead of Christmas, you boys would start looking for the best shoot or limb of Ethel that would serve as a tree. Then some of our friends in Premont started coming out, and could we spare them a tree? He says as late as the year he left the farm, we had from 8 to 10 requests. One night, Alfred was so tired and sleepy, he crawled up into my lap and requested I sing him a song, just anything to keep from going to bed. So this was what I sang to him. Diddle, diddle, dumpling, my son John went to bed with his breeches on. One shoe off, one shoe on, diddle, diddle, dumpling, my son John. But this failed to do the trick, and he requested an encore. I crossed him up a bit and changed the tune a little, about like this. Diddle, diddle, dumpling, my son Alfred said he was ready to jump into bed. But he had his pants and both shoes on, so I think I'll just throw him out to sleep with the dogs. Now, this brought a violent reaction, and he insisted he did have on his pajamas, and I was wrong. So in the argument, I tossed him into bed, and Betty followed him quickly, and soon all was peaceful again. Another night, it was Dorothy that crawled up into my lap to be cuddled a while. I sang him a couple of ditties and thought he was asleep, but he first opened his eyes and requested another song. He was having trouble staying awake, and I looked at him and said, "You're a tired little boy, ain't you?" He answered, "Uh-huh." Again, my reply, "I am tired, too. I bet I'm tireder than you are." Manfully, he pulled himself back to life and answered, "Uh-uh. I'm tireder than you." "Well, now, if you're tireder than me, just how tired are you?" Now, this was almost too much for a sleepy little boy, but he struggled and finally got it out. "I'm tireder than old Buck." And with that, he gave up and dropped off to sleep. I tucked him into his bed and told your mother about it and asked for an explanation of such a startling comparison. She had the answer easily. In his little world, which was the farm, only live things like humans and animals can get tired. Obviously, the bigger, the more tired. And old Buck the Mule was the biggest thing on the farm. Simple. Hi, diddle, diddle, the cat and the fiddle. The cow jumped over the moon, and the little dog laughed to see such sport, and the dish ran away with a spoon. Hush-a-bye, baby, in a treetop, when the wind blows, the cradle will rock. But if the bough breaks, the cradle will fall, and down will come baby, cradle and all. Well, this new year was ushered in properly. You all ate the usual black-eyed peas like good Texans for good health and a prosperous year. Evelyn has the idea you get 75 more days for each new food you partake of. So at the dance New Year's night at Portland, some of our northern visitors had a new experience. They were served black-eyed peas, of course. One Rockport lady insisted you gain one more day for each single black-eyed pea you eat on New Year's Day. Gerard insists this is just a fraud put out by the Texas growers to sell their crop of peas. Well, we will turn back the time clock a bit again. Alfred asked about refrigeration in our earlier days. I forgot much of this. The first part of my life, there was no refrigeration, as we consider it today. All of the houses we lived in had cellars until we came to Texas. And in the north, cellars are cooler than floors above them, particularly when the floor is earthen. That is, the cellar floor. Usually the water wells were quite deep and the water nice and cool. Almost everyone did lots of canning in glass mason jars, and these products were stored in the cellars in racks or shelves. Milk and butter would be kept in suitable containers and in hot summer weather kept in covered dish pans of fresh cold water from the well or in the cellar or both. Eggs were a problem unless you had your own chickens, which we did. Butter was a terrible problem unless you were a good customer of a grocer and you could impress on him you wouldn't accept anything but the sweetest and the best. Of course, we had our own supply of milk, butter, and eggs, but in our later years, we did run out often, which wasn't a problem. During those years, I was always working around a grocery store and quickly learned which farmer brought in the choice products. At home, when we were little kids, we had more milk than we could use and peddled milk to regular customers in the neighborhood. The customer had to have two milk pails, and it was up to her to see to it that they were kept clean and sterile. We delivered fresh at each milking, picking up the empty pail each time. It cost 5 cents a quart, and don't recall ever delivering more than a quart to one place. Sometimes a pint, yes. This money, when collected, was saved up to the weekend and then divided among we kids as our allowance. I don't recall what it amounted to, but the biggest ones got there first for the mostest. But we didn't quarrel about it. At that age of 10, I got a regular job of sweeping down the stairs every day for a lawyer. Got 50 cents a month. And with the first month's wages, I opened a bank account. And I will say George Rupp, the cashier, treated me with all due respect. There I've done it again, been changing the subject, so we start over. I mentioned before walls were quite cool, even in summer, and it was quite common practice to hang your milk containers and even the butter down into the well with a rope, kept real well. We did this in Carlinville, and again when we went back to Mount Pulaski. Back at Mount Pulaski, we rented a little house down on the south side of town from Billy Binder, who ran the wagon shop and blacksmith shop. Wasn't too much of a house, but served the purpose and cost us $6 a month rent. Did have a nice yard and trees and a good cellar and a garden and a well and a cistern. I had to walk over a mile each morning to get the fresh milk for the family. We knew these people well and felt sure of the product we would receive. Owned a local brickyard, and he had been mother's violin teacher. They kept the cow for their own use and had more than they could use. We hung the milk down the well as usual, but one day uptown I saw the most marvelous contraption, like a little house with a windlass in its top that sat on the top of the well. Going down into the well was a guided cage that held a series of shelves. Load your stuff in the shelves, turn the wheel to lower the stuff down close to the water, and you're right off the top of the hog. It was wonderful, but it was too convenient. Mother found too many dishes to cool. I paid no attention to that rope, and it frayed, and one day dropped the whole caboodle into the well. What a mess. Had to pump the well dry and get a ladder down in there and clean up the mess. It was a job, but we got it taken care of. Hardest part was keeping Gerard from following me down there. He knew he should be helping me. After that, I watched that rope, and we had no trouble after that. When we moved to Carlinville, we took it along and used it for some time. In Carlinville, we got our first real refrigerator. The standard refrigerator was an upright box with a lid on top to open and put in the ice. Then on the front lower two-thirds was a door open to shelves for food, but this new one was different. It was square, with three doors all on front. The upper half of the left side was a door to put in ice. Below it, a door and shelves for food. The right side was one big door and all shelves. It was about half again as large as a regular icebox. Then in addition, it had a metal coiled pipe at the bottom of the ice compartment for the ice to rest on. One end of the pipe ended out in front between the doors and had a regular faucet attached. On the other end, it came up through the top of the box, ending in a glass bottle upside down. This bottle, in an appropriate holder, held about 3 gallons and had a hole in the bottom sticking up. A hole was in the bottom of this bottle, and all you had to do was insert a funnel and fill it with water, and automatically you had ice water whenever you were thirsty. That coil lasted several years and then gave out. I rebuilt the coil using regular U-joints. This was difficult, but the boys at the garage managed it by slightly bending those short pipes, and then we were back in business again. As you boys grew older and had more playmates, your mother finally had to limit your usage of the facility, as she was constantly running out of ice. And here I am in Texas without mentioning it. Better get back to Mount Pulaski. That little house we lived in had a tar paper roof over the shingles. Very satisfactory, but one day we had an unusually hard hailstorm, some bigger than hen eggs. Lots of damage done, and with the first rain, our roof leaked all over. I got up and looked at it, and it was covered with little pits from that hailstorm. I told Billy about it and agreed to paint it with tar paint if he'd furnish the paint. It was a deal, and I got busy. I was working hard. When I paused, I heard little footsteps behind me. Gerard had seen the ladder, climbed up to help me, and I made the mistake of letting him stay if he sat real still, and I shouldn't have done it. When we finally went down, he had more tar on him than I did, and your mother liked to have had a fit. I had to finish the job with no assistance. Tonner says we got our first real refrigerator in 1933. It was an Electrolux and burned kerosene. Then a short time later, we got a butane system and a new stove, and the Electrolux was changed to use butane. When we moved to Alice, it was changed again to burn natural gas. Back there somewhere in the 30s, we added onto the house and added a wash house, which also had a full bathroom facilities. Gerard added the septic tank all by himself, and what help Tonner gave, even built the form and poured in the concrete. He liked to lost one of his toes when he dropped the form on it. Along this time, we got electric lights. They started putting lights out our way, ending at Hanson's. I asked for lights too, but they wanted $1,500 to bring the lines to us. Instead, I bought one of those little air motors, and it worked like a charm. Tonner said we started with a 12-volt set, but quickly changed to the regulation 32-volt set. Now we were cooking on all the burners. We had lights in every room, even in the milk shed and the wash house. First thing we added was a radio, cute little thing, set on the table, had a dial, and it sure played. Cost $36. In that day and time, when you listened to the radio, everybody sat facing the radio and stared at it intently. We were very happy with that air motor. One time I made a trip with Jim's brother Frank over into the Rockport country. For some reason, he wanted to cross over the bay, and we passed a Catholic church and other buildings. Later, I learned it was a retreat for priests. For some reason, Frank stopped, and I strolled around. I met a priest, an elderly man, and we chatted. I had noticed an air motor on the grounds and mentioned it to him and how wonderful it was. He looked very uncertain and answered, "Yes, it is. It goes round and round. Then I go inside and turn a button and the lights go on. There must be some connection." You kids had a lot of fun chasing jackrabbits down in the lagoon. No, you never caught any, but both you and the dogs thought it was a lot of fun. I don't suppose you remember what the old Model T Ford looked like. The front fenders came out from the frame at a slant, while the hood folded down like a perfectly square box. This left a V-shaped space big enough for one of you kids to crouch down and ride in. The headlights were on a rod stretching across from the fender to fender. This gave you something to hold on to. We would take to the lagoon, a boy on each fender, and the dogs running wild. Usually the ground was not too rough, and the yelling and barking was as wild as the rabbits. We had a searchlight on the Ford, so sometimes we tried it out after dark with the headlights on. You never seemed to tire of the sport. When we moved from San Antonio, we came down in the old Dodge. All cars had running boards in those days, and Bill the dog loved to ride there. He could feel the breeze and see more. We came by Corpus, and as we came down Chaparral Street going south, he was riding on the right running board. We made a U-turn, which was allowed in those days, and just as we finished the last turn, some other dog saw Bill and barked, and of course he answered, lost his balance and footing and rolled. We couldn't stop immediately, and you kids were sure we had lost him for good. He seemed to be glad to be found, and this time he got back into the car. We had a new well drilled on the farm when we first went there. Turned out to be very good. At first, we pumped water by compressed air, compressor powered by an old bulldog engine. A huge single-cylinder monster, but very efficient. Its worst complaint, you had to start it up every time you needed water. At first, our water supply was limited to a couple of steel drums at the well and a water line laid on top of the ground down to the house. Later, we installed a large windmill with a walking beam that pumped a lot of water. Then you boys, helped by Florencio, dug the big tank. Right on top of the gentle slope so water could flow every direction, 100 foot in diameter circle, and the deepest part close to 8 feet. The windmill filled it and kept it full. We had two diving boards, one from the west bank and one near the center. On the north of the tank, we built our corral. You also built a concrete water trough for the stock there. We had a small pipe running from the tank, fed water into the stock tank by gravity. Was controlled with a special float valve. We had Mr. Friesian build us a nice large concrete tank for the house water, and it filled automatically whenever the mill turned. This was an ideal arrangement. Right at the last of our tenure on the farm, the mill was getting old, the water level dropped also, so we turned back to the most modern new four-cylinder engine and the old air compressor. But the windmill memory still remained the longest. One day I went down on the street here in Alice and ran into Albino Canales. He was looking for someone to drive him home. I don't know how he happened to be there with his car and alone. He had just listened to a weather report that a hurricane would hit us hours earlier than expected. He thought I might be wanting to go home. They say the good Lord arranges things, and this time I'm sure it happened that way. He took me home, and then he drove back to his home alone. They tell me he seldom drove on account of his right hand. We got busy and nailed up the house and fastened down everything that we could. Then we sat down and visited and waited. But come it did. I thought it would wreck everything. That wind was terrible, and it kept it up so long. Now we were not versed on hurricanes as much as we are today. For instance, we knew nothing of that eye and the lull that comes in the middle. Well, when we were about beat down to a frazzle and ready to give up, came that lull and almost perfect quiet. All of a sudden it was over, and the house with everything closed up was uncomfortable. Someone yelled, "Let's go swimming." And up to the tank we rushed. Who could get to the north bank first? Oh, it was great. Mother had stayed back at the house. We got near the center of the pool, and all terror broke loose. A vicious wind twisted and picked up water in drops and drove it like steel bullets. It hurt, and you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. Waves like you couldn't imagine on such a pool. I finally reached the north bank and was soon joined by Sonny and Tonner. We agreed we had to find the two little boys, and quickly So we started back green to meet where the water came into the pool. We got back there and again met but with no success. So we started out a third time. We were about to the middle, and all of a sudden came a brief lull and a little let up, and there were the two little boys. Oh, it was a relief to see them. We hustled them out of the pool and down to the house and asked them how they managed to get through it. They had answers. Alfred had got under the diving platform where he had some protection. Doherty said those drops hurt too much, so he just started swimming underwater till it was over. All of them could swim underwater for unbelievable lengths of time. They played a game of tag in which they were underwater more time than on top, so it was not new for him.